immediately after I speak with them, and I would be astonished if they cannot find your fawn in short order."
Somehow, that was all he needed to get his panic under control and be able to think again. "Thank you," he replied, weak-kneed with gratitude.
"Oh, this is self-interest as well," the stag told him frankly. "And quite frankly, although the fawn acted impulsively, he is in the right, and you are in the wrong. You should, at the very least, have decided to come consult me about this as soon as you had that much information. A group of armed men out here, where there was, to my knowledge, nothing but tiny villages, a few farms and wilderness. These people could potentially move into our territory and prey on some of my herd before we were aware of them."
Mags felt the King Stag's weighty disapproval and winced.
"So I will help you, but be advised. I never do anything for only one reason."
As that seemed to be that, Mags bid the stag a respectful farewell and broke the connection. He wiped his sweating forehead on his sleeve and tried to think of something. Anything that he could do besides wait for dawn.
"Do you think Arvel and Ryu could help?" he asked Dalin.
"They are both more fragile than they like to admit. They would try, but they would be injured and end up being a burden instead of a help," Dalin replied. "And at this point, I recommend against using the mind speech relay to inform the king of anything except the existence of these people. Amelie would certainly be informed of Parry's disappearance." Dalin didn't add anything to that, but he didn't have to, because Mags knew the rest.
"Amelie would murder me."
The ravens arrived at dawn. Four of them landed first in the trees around the little grove, then down on the ground next to Parry's deserted bed. They were young ones, if Mags was any judge. And this saddled him with a new problem. He didn't have animal mind speech. So as they sat there in the little grove staring at each other, he racked his brain for some way to communicate with them.
"Dalin, can you talk to them?"
he finally asked.
"Perhaps. I can try."
Dalin looked down his long nose at the birds. They turned to face him, which was, Mags thought, an indicator of initial success at least. And so he waited, patiently, as his companion and the four birds stared at each other. Dalin did not move at all. The birds occasionally clacked their beaks or flipped their wing feathers. He hardly dared breathe, terrified that if he disturbed them, they'd break whatever fragile strand of communication they had. His muscles were aching with tension when Dalin finally raised his head, and the birds shook themselves and turned back to look at him.
"I think I made them understand what Parry has done, and that it puts him in danger. First, they will go to the inn and see if Parry is there. If he is not, they are going to look for a place where there are many men gathered within a day's walk of that inn. And if they find such a place, they will look for Parry there first, then between there and the inn. They are fairly certain that wherever humans are, there will be smoke from cook fires, which they can easily see."
He let out his breath in a long sigh, then had an idea.
"Can you ask them to wait a moment before they take off?"
Dalin turned his gaze back on the birds, and Mags fished in his pack for paper and thread. He got twigs and charred one end, and tied a scrap of paper and a twig to one leg of each of the four birds. They looked at their new burdens curiously, pecked at them a little, then looked at him and nodded. He spread his hands wide. They took that as a sign to take off.
"Should we stay here or try to trace his tracks?" Mags asked his companion.
"The ravens and the Daihili know to look for us here," Dalin reminded him, "and neither of us is much good at tracking in the wilderness. The best thing we can do now is collect food in case we don't have a chance to hunt for any once they find Parry, so that we have some sort of supplies with us."
Once they find Parry. If they could find Parry. If he wasn't already a slave or worse. His anxiety started to ramp up again. And his guilt. This was all because he'd just shut his own child down without listening to him. Sure, they might both be in danger now instead of just Parry, but at least they would be in danger together. Parry had thought he was never going to get to sleep. Sleeping in a dog kennel, in the middle of the enemy, something he'd never done before, should have been enough to keep him awake. Add to that, he had no idea how he was going to get himself out of this fortress within a city, much less out of the city, no idea how he could tell his father where he was, and no plans whatsoever, it seemed a recipe for insomnia. But he'd been working feverishly all day, and his nerves had entirely masked how tired he was. Once he had a full belly, Laurel had lain down beside him, and the dogs had settled. The next thing he knew, it was dawn, and he was waking up. The first thing he did was let the dogs out into the yard, and only a handful of them started to relieve themselves in a place other than the designated corner. A simple correction, and they hurriedly went to join the pack. Well, that was something, at least. His control over them seemed to be absolute. If he ran and they tried to set the dogs to find him, he could have the pack running in circles while he escaped.
If I can find a way out.
The sun was just touching the horizon when the men with the barrows arrived with the dogs' morning food. Perry examined it carefully and was satisfied, and grateful that Lady Dia's kennel master had taught him so much. It was a good mix of all parts of the animals it had been cut from, with what looked like just a bit of crushed oats mixed in to give the dogs some roughage. Whoever had been making the food for these fellows knew enough about them to feed them right. As he had last night, he lined the dogs up and gave each of them a measured portion. There was some scuffling before he made it very clear to the more dominant dogs that he and Laurel were not going to permit any stealing of another dog's food. Then the four helpers arrived, and he set them to cleaning up the mess in the corner of the yard. It was hard to tell, since they showed no expression whatsoever except a constant bemusement, but he thought they seemed relieved that it was confined to one easy-to-clean space. He cleaned himself up, turned the dogs loose in the yard, and considered what he should do for the rest of the day. But he hadn't gotten very far with that when the same boy as last night arrived with a new pail. The lad grabbed the old one from the night before and was about to flee when Perry seized his wrist. The child froze, terrified.
"Are you one of the people these men kidnapped at the inn?"
he whispered. The boy's mouth dropped open, and he stared at Perry with eyes so wide he looked like a startled owl. He glanced from side to side, guiltily, to make sure there was no one else around, then gave a tiny nod.
"How many of you are there?"
he asked.
"Dunno,"
the boy whispered back.
"Me and two boys does the fetching. There's some women, but we never see 'em. They's for the master. They's some men does the chopping and digging and stuff."
"You're not working in a mine?"
Perry asked. The boy shook his head vigorously.
"What mine? I ain't seen nor heard of no mine. I gotta get back. I gotta get back or I get beat."
Perry let him go.
"Thank you,"
he said. The boy ignored his thanks and sped off. Perry opened the pail to discover another piece of last night's boiled pudding and salted peas porridge. He ate quickly and left the pail outside the door to the kennel where the boy could get it without coming in. If this had been Lady Dia's kennel, he'd have taken the dogs for a good long walk or a run. The more they worked, and the more he worked with them, the better it would be for him. Well, he still could take them for a run, just not outside the compound, and it would demonstrate his control over them to everyone inside the compound. He whistled to get their attention. When every head in the yard was looking in his direction, he let his eyes rake over the pack and ordered, "Follow!" They followed, as obediently as baby ducks following their mother. He was literally chest deep in dogs, his own head barely higher than theirs. He led them out of the kennel and straight to the fence around the compound. One circuit of the compound ought to be enough, he reckoned. He had barely gotten the pack to the fence before he had an audience. Work near him ceased entirely. The mercenaries stared, goggling at him, walking in the middle of his pack of enormous mastiffs. There was an air of uncertainty about the men, as if they were not quite sure what to think. He grinned, reinforced his command to the dogs to follow as they reached the fence, and broke into a run. It wasn't much of a run so far as the dogs were concerned, but they enjoyed it, loping along beside and behind him. By now, every man in the yard, it seemed, was watching them, either covertly as they worked or overtly. He heard murmurs that sounded astonished from those nearest. As the pack ran along the back fence of the compound, he wasn't just running with the dogs. His eyes were darting everywhere, and he was taking notes. This was odd. There just didn't seem to be that many men here, given the size of the city. and Laurel had said that the city itself was deserted. Was this it? Just a few handfuls of mercenaries and slaves occupying this vast mausoleum of a city? He and the dogs raced up the far side of the compound, past the side of the big building there, and turned to race across the front. The front part of the courtyard was still deserted, but he thought he sensed something. As though there was someone watching from the huge building. Well, that was probably where this master was, and where the master was, there would be servants. So even if the master wasn't interested in a mere dog boy, the servants would be, which accounted for the sense of being watched.
There are people in there, Laurel confirmed. I can smell them. Females as well as males. And some of them smell very strange.
How strange? He asked, but Laurel couldn't seem to articulate it. I hope that boy doesn't tell anyone I'm not as addled as I'm making out. He grimaced a little as he ran. Stopping the boy and making him talk had probably been a very stupid thing to do, but without mind speech, how would he have been able to find anything out from the youngling? He wished his father were here. But if father were here, we'd be separated, and the gods only know what they'd be doing to him. When he and the pack rounded the last corner and moved into the back part of the courtyard again, everyone seemed to have gone back to their jobs. But he could tell from the covert glances that they were still watching, so he decided to give them a show. He stopped halfway between the kennel and the fence, and the pack stopped with him. He made a twirling motion with his hand and gave them the mental image of what he wanted, and they ran around him in a tight circle at their top speed. First Diosil, then Widdershins. That accomplished two things. It proved his ability with them, and it wore them out a little. When they were starting to pant, he stopped them and had them all sit down at once. Then he ordered them to lie down, which they were very happy to do at that point. Now he was definitely being stared at again. He cast a glance at the kennel door. It was wide open, as he had left it. He pointed at it dramatically and gave them the command to head back to what they considered to be home at a run. They jumped to their feet and streamed toward the door, stopping for nothing. Meanwhile, he took his time in a leisurely stroll to the door, entering and closing it behind him when he arrived. The dogs were lapping up their fill of water and were perfectly willing to flop down all over the kennel after that exertion. He went outside to check on the progress his helpers had made in cleaning the yard. That was when he heard the quark of ravens overhead, and heard in his mind,
Raven friend, father seeks you.
He managed not to start.
What we do?
The raven continued.
Father sent us to find you, help you, then go back, show where you are.
One of you land in the yard, please, he told the four of them. Just one. Peck around in the yard for a little, then come in the door. I'll be just inside. He sauntered back inside and waited. It seemed to take forever before a bold, bright-eyed raven with a piece of paper tied to one leg stalked in the doorway, spotted him, and hopped over to him as he squatted down to get on its level. It held still politely as he untied the paper from its leg and saw that there was a charred twig along with it. That was smart, but he had something better. The copper where the water was heated was black with soot, which would work just fine as a sort of ink. The paper wasn't big, and he had to be careful not to smear the things he was writing, but he managed to get a few words about what he was doing down and tied the paper around the raven's leg again. Then something occurred to him. Do the rest of you have papers?
Yes!
The raven replied, eyeing some of the dog's meat that had been left over. Eat your fill, then send another down until I have all the papers, he said. More as a suggestion than an order.
I like you, raven friend,
the youngster declared, then made two flaps to get himself to the pile of meat and began swallowing chunks of it. It wasn't long until he was satisfied, and he sauntered out the door and flapped off into the sky. A second raven stalked inside, and they repeated what he had done with the first. Perry kept his mind firmly on the task at hand, and not on the questions without answers that were flooding through his mind right now. When he had finished with the last of the birds, he sent them all on their way, hoping no one had noticed them marching into and out of the kennel. Then, once they were gone, he got up and staggered to his bed. Several of the dogs, sensing his distress and emotional turmoil, wandered over to him and licked his hands and face to try to comfort him. If he hadn't been so overwrought, he probably would have laughed. There is nothing quite like having your face licked by a tongue that is bigger than your hand. But now that he had given his father the little information he had, he was all too conscious of what a hash he had made of this. He didn't know how to get away from this compound, nor out of the city. His father certainly couldn't break in here to rescue him, and even though he was right in the heart of this place, he didn't even know the most basic things about it, like how many mercenaries were here, or how many of the kidnapped victims were still alive. In fact, the more he thought about what a mess he had made of the situation, the more he felt like bursting into tears.
"You are forgetting something," Laurel said calmly.
He sniffed and wiped his eyes on his sleeve.
"What?"
"Your father is an extremely powerful mind speaker. He can even mind speak with people who have no gift at all. Once the ravens bring him here, he should be able to find a spot near enough to us that he can speak directly to you."
Laurel nudged his way in among the dogs and laid himself down next to Perry.
"Let him concentrate on that, while we concentrate on learning as much as we can."
He wanted to believe Laurel.
"I will count all the men in this courtyard, if that will make you feel any better. Once we know how many there are, we will have a better idea of how we can escape them."
He sniffed again and smiled weakly.
"All right, but what if they—"
"I will perform tricks for them and beg for food. And if they become aggressive with me, I will run back here. I very much doubt they will try to hurt me."
"All right, but be careful."
When Laurel went out into the yard, he went and washed his face, then picked up a shovel and went out into the fenced area to clean it with his helpers. And as he repeated the mechanical motions, he was watching through Laurel's eyes. The first group of men he spotted were sparring, so he didn't approach them. There were 10 of them, in 5 pairs, with another 10 waiting on the sidelines while an instructor corrected them. To Perry's eyes, these men were good. Very good. If this was the general caliber of the mercenaries this master had hired, then they'd be more than a match for the Valdemarin Guard. This wasn't some unorganized bandit rabble. These were real, professional soldiers.
I wonder where they came from.
Surely not the Pellagir Hills. He couldn't imagine the Hawk brothers allowing a group like this to set up housekeeping in their territory.
"There are many, many leagues of cleansed lands between the Pellagir Hills and the Dorisha Plains past your border along its southernmost western edge," Laurel told him. "And while you Valdemarans may not know this, those lands are populated. There are all manner of minor lordlings. A mercenary company can easily find employment there."
Well, that was something that was never talked about in the lectures on Valdemar's neighbors.
Probably one of those lordlings discovered this place, liked it better than his own keep and moved in. Now he's trying to populate it.
That didn't sound likely. It didn't match what he'd seen so far. A lordling would have at least a village worth of craftsmen, farmers, and servants. There just seemed to be a mercenary company here, some servants, a few kidnapped people, and this master. Though trying to repopulate this place seemed likely, this master was going about it all wrong. Once people got wind of the fact that there was an entire empty city out here, he wouldn't have to kidnap anyone. Younger sons, people with pasts to escape, craftsmen looking for a new start would all flock here. You could empty out the poorer quarters of any big town just by letting people know there were houses free for the taking. There was something altogether not making any sense.
"Then there must be a great deal we do not know and must learn," Laurel said thoughtfully, padding up to a group of mercenaries who were working on repairing and cleaning armor and weapons.
And here, Laurel noticed something else peculiar.
"These men are afraid. Not greatly afraid, but definitely fearful of something, and it is not me."
The yard was completely clean now. The urine washed away, the dung in a pile outside the yard gate. Perry directed his helpers to sweep out the kennel. Really, there were actually too many helpers for the amount of work. He could only think that the kennel had gotten into the state he had found it because there had been no one supervising them. Left to themselves, He suspected they would clean the same patch of ground or floor over and over while urine and dung piled up next to them.
What are they doing, besides smelling of fear and working? He asked.
Now and again they look up at that big building, as if they expect something unpleasant to come from it at any moment.
So, whoever this master was, he controlled these men by fear. Could you even do that with mercenaries? Surely they could have chosen to leave at any time if there was only one master. This was becoming stranger and more alarming with every new thing he learned.
By the time Laurel finished counting, he knew there were between 50 and 60 fighting men here in the compound. Some of the outbuildings were clearly meant to be stables, but the men had fitted them up as living quarters. A very good kitchen had been set up in one of them as well. Laurel managed to beg meat scraps from the charmed cook. The little boy seemed to be the cook's errand lad. The cook treated the boy with what could best be described as indifference, though others that passed through the area didn't hesitate to cuff or kick him if he was in the way. Clearly, they knew nothing about how to handle children. As Perry knew personally, and had seen in his stint as a palace page, there were better ways to get more work out of a youngling than hitting them whenever they put a foot wrong. So, there were as many as 60 men in the compound, possibly another 30 or so out hunting and bringing in wood and other supplies they could get in the forest, say, 20 manning the gates and patrolling the wall. So, 100? Far too many for a standard detachment of guards to take on.
Wait, there must be more guarding the prisoners to make sure they are working and not escaping.
As many as 120, then.
Well, at least Father was right about one thing. Something like this, the king would have to approve any sort of force. And I still don't know why all these men are so terrified of the master.
When Laurel returned, the kennel and the yard were spotless. Perry took pity on his feeble-minded helpers, made up 4 more crude beds with pine needles, and told them to sleep. Poor fellows. He wondered just how they had gotten those injuries, which seemed very similar. Too similar to be coincidence. Now that the dogs were completely tractable around him, Perry decided to inspect their ears for problems. Mastiffs, with their heavy, droopy ears, were prone to such things. He was working on the 4th one when the captain turned up at the kennel door. And this time, the man looked unnerved.
Dog boy!
He called, unable to see Perry from where he was standing. Perry dismissed the dog he was working on and stood up.
Dog boy!
He replied.
Come here, dog boy!
The captain ordered, and he looked him up and down. Now that the heavy work of cleaning the kennel and yard was complete, Perry had managed to keep the canvas trews and tunic reasonably clean, and the captain nodded a little.
The master wants to see you, dog boy, he said.
Perry nodded.
I'll take you to him, and your dog too.
The captain waited for a response. Perry whistled, and Laurel padded up to stand beside him.
Now listen. Be very, very good,
the captain told him, then bent close to his ear and whispered urgently,
and whatever you do, don't eat anything if he offers it to you.
Perry tilted his head to the side like a dog hearing a strange noise.
No eat, master, food,
the captain amended. Perry nodded.
Dog boy, he said, no eat.
Good.
The captain gestured to him to follow.
Let's go.
13. As Perry had suspected they would, they went around to the front of the big building, up the staircase to the 2nd floor, and entered through the double doors. Once inside, the temperature dropped. It was dark, with very little light coming in those tall, narrow windows, and the strange, uneasy feeling of being watched only increased until Perry felt as if there were 1,000 pairs of eyes on him. The first room they entered stretched along the entire width of the building and was absolutely empty, but as Perry's eyes adjusted, he realized something. This room was built with exactly the same wood as the outside, and the color of the wooden walls of the buildings here was not silver with age. It was naturally silver-colored. He had never seen wood like that. This room's walls, floor, and ceiling were fashioned of that same silvery wood. It looked as though something had drained all the color out of the room. But he wasn't supposed to be noticing things like that. He was supposed to be following the captain. And so he did, through more stark empty, silver-colored rooms until they came to an inner staircase and climbed it to the third floor. At the top of this stair, two more of the mercenaries were posted as guards. A long hallway ran down the middle of this floor, at the end of which on the right was another staircase. The hallway was lined with doors, some open, allowing light to penetrate into the hallway of those rooms. Now there were signs of people living here. Some basic benches along the walls of the hallway, a faint smell of food, and more guards on the rooms with the closed doors. The captain led Perry and Laurel to the left, past them, and all the way to the other end of the long hallway, where there was a set of double doors and four more guards. The captain didn't say a word, but gestured at the right-hand guard, who quickly opened the right-hand door for them. Perry followed the captain inside, keeping his eyes on the floor, and stopped when he stopped. First, he glanced briefly to either side. This was another huge room, mostly empty. There were benches at intervals along the walls and not much else, not even curtains or shutters for the windows. Then he looked up through the curtain of his hair and realized that was clearly because all attention was intended to be on the throne directly opposite the door, and its occupant. Throne was the only word that could possibly be used to describe the enormous, yet curiously square seat opposite them. It was at the top of three steps, on a dais, and it was exactly as broad as it was tall. It had armrests of a sort, and a pad not unlike a mattress was stretched over them and onto the seat, a brown velvet pad that looked like the color of dried blood to Perry. The throne itself was gold, real gold. It was unlikely the throne was solid gold, but it certainly had a thick enough gold skin that no wood or stone grain was visible, just the burnished metal, so the master certainly didn't lack for means. And the creature that occupied the throne was as odd as the throne itself. He, Perry assumed it was a he, lounged indolently on the throne, leaning his weight on the arm to Perry's left. He towered over them, and his height had very little to do with the dais the throne was on. Perry estimated that, standing, the captain would barely come up to the middle of his chest, and the captain was not a small man. He was bald, and his cranium was enormous. Just the upper part of his head, which bulged with blue veins. His eyes were the strangest color that Perry had ever seen in a human being. Yellow. Golden yellow, as gold as the color of the throne. His entire face narrowed down to a pointed, hairless chin, just barely wider than his thumb. His body was thin and gangling, as if, to get his incredible height, someone had taken a normal-sized man and pulled him vertically, stretching everything out unnaturally. He wore a shapeless, sleeveless shirt of sorts, something that looked like random scarves sewn together, which only accentuated his strange proportions, and his lower limbs were enveloped in baggy trews of some soft fabric. All this Perry took in at a single glance right before Laurel snapped at him, "Shield!" Perry used the most effective and safest shield he had at his disposal, a false outer mind that only reflected the muddled thoughts of the addled dog boy he was supposed to be, memories of food, of dogs, of being beaten and starved in no particular order. Memories of his new dog pack overlaid with satisfaction. He dropped his eyes to stare at his feet.
"I have brought the new dog boy as you ordered, master,"
the captain said in a subdued and subservient voice.
"This is he, and the dog he brought with him."
"Look at me, dog boy,"
the master ordered. Perry raised his eyes and let a memory of a wolf and the wolf's golden eyes slide through the ones of dogs. He didn't have to feign fear. If Laurel had ordered him to shield himself, then there was something to fear in this strange creature.
"What is your name?"
Perry felt a rough, mental hand running over his mind. Pretty certain that even the ungifted would be able to sense a touch like that, he allowed his surface thoughts to roil with confusion and apprehension.
"Dog boy,"
he said.
"Just that? Have you never had another name?"
the master persisted. He let memories of living with dogs flood through his surface thoughts.
"Dog boy," he repeated.
That was when he felt himself seized in a remorseless mental grip and it was all he could do to keep up the surface persona. He allowed his own terror to boil over and add to the very real pain, and he dropped to the floor, clutching his head.
Dog boy!
He screamed desperately.
Dog boy!
Laurel growled and moved quickly to stand over him, still growling but otherwise did nothing. A moment later, the terrible grip released him. He remained on the floor, whimpering while Laurel licked his face. When he finally sat up, he was unsurprised to find that his brain felt bruised and it ached horribly. As soon as he sat up, he went down on his knees, prostrating himself before the strange creature on the throne, leaving his surface thoughts full of pain and terror.
There, there now, dog boy,
the master said in caressing tones.
We didn't mean to hurt you.
And a healing feeling, like warm honey, flooded over him, taking away some of the pain of his bruised mind.
You can stand up if you like.
Cautiously, he sat up, then stood up. The master clapped his hands, and a few moments later, a cowed and terrified man arrived with a tray on which was arrayed what looked like a half dozen cuts of meat, cooked rare. It had a sweet, odd smell, something like pork.
Are you hungry, dog boy?
The master asked in a silken, smooth voice. Remembering what the captain had told him, Perry shook his head and allowed nausea to wash over him. There was something very wrong about that meat, and he wouldn't have touched it if he had been starving.
Dog boy,
he said weakly, making a motion as if he was gagging.
All right. We're pleased with you, dog boy. We're pleased with what we have heard about you. You may continue to serve us.
The creature turned his attention back to the captain.
You have done well, captain. Our pack has a worthy caretaker now. Your gift and reward will be waiting in your quarters. You should be pleased with it.
Whatever the master deigns to gift me with, it will be more than I deserve,
the captain said quickly.
The master laughed. Of course it will be, you silly thing. That's why it's a gift. Enjoy it.
He waved a languid hand at them.
You may leave us now.
The captain bowed and backed out of the room. Perry followed his example, and as for Laurel, the Kyrie crawled backward on his belly until he was out of the room as well. The captain didn't breathe freely until they were well clear of the throne room and the doors were closed. Perry saw then that he had been sweating profusely. Perry might have been doing the same, except that fear had chilled him rather than making him sweat. His guide stood there a moment, then passed his hand over his face, pausing to massage his temples. The two guards stared straight ahead, as if he and the captain weren't even there. Perry wondered if that was just discipline, or if the master was controlling them. He hoped it was discipline. The captain gestured for Perry to follow and broke into a trot. Perry was only too happy to follow suit. He personally felt that he couldn't get far enough away from that thing in the throne room. If, at that moment, he'd been given an opportunity to flee this place, he would have, and never mind the consequences. They moved quickly out of the building, down the stairs, taking them two at a time and around to the back, and it was only when they were nearly to the kennel that the captain finally slowed down. The captain still had not spoken a single word by the time they reached the kennel. Only when they stopped at the door of the kennel did he break his silence.
Go lie down, dog boy, he said. Your head will be all right after you lie down for a while.
And with that, he left Perry at the kennel door and hurried back to his men. Perry went inside the kennel where he was greeted with enthusiastic joy by the dogs, so much so that he sat down among them and let them slobber all over him to their heart's content. Being licked by them felt 100 times cleaner than having his mind manhandled by the master. In fact, the entire episode had left him feeling sick and filthy, as if something foul had been crawling through his mind.
I do not think I have ever seen so powerful a mind-speaker, Laurel said, subdued. We are very, very lucky you only have animal mind-speech, and that he could not reach you directly as your father can. He could have killed you with a thought.
Perry shivered and fondled as many doggy heads as he could reach.
We need to warn Father. If Father tries to mind-speak me and runs into the master before he finds me,
he quelled panic.
See if any of the ravens are overhead or in the forest, Laurel suggested.
Even though his head ached more every time he used his gift, he did as Laurel requested and discovered that there were now 8 ravens out there instead of the original 4. 4 of them were circling over the compound while the rest perched in trees in the forest outside the city. He begged one to come but cautioned it to be very careful, giving it a mental image of what the master had done to him. He was unsurprised to sense the raven's contempt for anything the master could do to them, and the bird did have a point. If the master was unaware that such a thing as bond birds existed, they could operate right under his nose without him noticing.
Did he even realize I use animal mind speech?
He wondered. There had been nothing in his thoughts about the dogs to reveal that, after all. He had gotten the distinct impression that what the master had done, mentally, to him, was what he did to every new man that came into the compound.
And that reminded him. What was wrong with that meat?
He asked Laurel, knowing his friend's superior sense of smell would have pinpointed exactly what had caused the captain to warn him not to eat any of it.
Was it poisoned? Drugged? It didn't smell at all right.
Oh, that, Laurel replied, already looking out the door for the raven. Nothing like that. It was human.
Within a quarter candle mark, the raven was on his way off to Mags, a message bound to his leg, written with exquisite care on a piece of fine cloth that Perry had cut from his clout, and using the sharpest twig and the best ink out of soot mixed with water that Perry could manage to produce. Each word had been carefully chosen to convey the danger. Laurel had even dictated some. And even when it was done, he was sick with fear that it wouldn't be urgent enough, that his father wouldn't understand it, or that he'd even dismiss some of it. But there was no other way to reach him and warn him. This would have to do, and he would pray to every god he'd ever heard of that it would be enough. When the raven was gone, there was nothing left for him to do but to act as if the interview with the master had never happened, as if, like the poor weak-minded dog boy he pretended to be, his memory was very short. His dinner arrived, but he set it aside. The pail would keep it warm enough, and right now, he was still nauseated. He guided his helpers in another round of cleaning the kennel. He cleaned some more of the dog's ears. He took the pack for another run of 3 circuits of the courtyard, fed them, finally had his own dinner, and saw everyone bedded down as soon as the sun started to set. By that time, his head had finally stopped throbbing, and the ache in his brain had faded quite a bit. Whatever the master was doing at that moment, he surely could not be monitoring the very dull activities of the dog boy. Perry allowed himself to relax a very little, and he spent a few moments just sitting quietly and not thinking about anything at all. His helpers filed out right at sunset, as they had the previous day. Evidently, they had somewhere other than the kennel where they slept and ate. He was just as glad they were going away. With what he'd learned about the master, he would not have been the least surprised to discover it had been the master who'd half-brained them by way of amusement or some sadistic experiment. And at that point, he became aware that he smelled distinctly doggy. Ugh. There was one lamp in the kennel, and he lit it so he could see what he was doing. He gave himself a thorough wash in nice hot water from the copper once the hounds were completely settled. That soap was crude and harsh, but he didn't care. At least after he was done, it didn't feel as if his skin were trying to crawl off his body. He opened the door into the yard so the dogs could wander out there to go if they needed to in the middle of the night. The dark sky overhead showed no moon, but it was spangled with stars, and a nice breeze wafted through, drying his naked skin. He washed his old clothing that had been soaking for 2 days, draped it over the stall walls to dry, changed to the second outfit he'd been given, and put the outfit he'd been wearing to soak in more hot soapy water. He very much doubted that anyone would think twice about a boy who was addled being so cleanly. The addled got strange obsessions about things, and cleanliness would be one of the least offensive things to be obsessed with. It had been a grueling day. He only realized how grueling it was when he finally lay down in his fragrant bed of pine needles, and the scent soothed his nerves and his head. He had actually fallen asleep and been asleep for some time when a soft touch on his dreams brought him awake in an instant.
Perry.
Papa, he thought, trying desperately to keep his thoughts quiet.
You, I got your message. I understand, and I am taking every possible precaution. The master is sound asleep, and other than making sure of that, I'm staying away from him.
He couldn't help himself. He actually wept with relief. He hadn't been completely sure his message would convey an urgent enough warning.
The King Stag of the Daihili managed to link me with the ravens, so I know where you are in that maze.
His heart leaped at that, but his father's next words sent it plummeting.
Unfortunately, I have no idea how to get you out. Not yet. But we'll figure out something, right?
He thought, trying not to sound too desperate, even though he was certainly feeling that way. There was silence in his head for a moment, as though his father was hesitating.
The fact that this master is such a powerful mind speaker, that he has controlled over 100 hardened fighting men, is extremely disturbing. The King Stag is actually quite agitated about this. I'd like you to stay there until we know what it is he can do, what his plans are, and whether he can be negotiated with.
Perry swallowed hard. Now that he was actually in touch with his father, he wasn't feeling nearly so competent. In fact, if anything, he was feeling the exact opposite. Lonely, scared, and very shaky. He didn't want to stay there and be a spy. What he wanted was to get out of there and home. But it had turned out, after all, that he had been right about the need to investigate the kidnappings, and now his father was relying on him. What's more, now that he had encountered the master in person, he had the very strong feeling that the danger to Valdemar was greater than any of them could guess. One thing he was absolutely certain about was this. Whatever the master's plans were, they didn't include negotiating with anyone.
"I will, father," he said, and added, "and I have a nice soft bed in a warm kennel. I'm not dodging sentries and patrols, and someone is feeding me cooked meals 3 times a day. I even have hot water. I'm better off than you are."
"So you are," Mags replied, and Perry sensed relief.
Probably relief that he hadn't objected or pleaded with his father to be taken out of this place immediately.
"It's a good thing he's no good at picking up emotions from that distance, or he'd know I'm lying."
"Get rid of any evidence you've been writing," Mags advised. "If you need to write to me again, I'll have the raven carry you a feather you can cut a quill from, and he'll take it with him when he leaves."
"Are you somewhere safe?"
Now worry about his father surfaced. There were patrols out there. For all Perry knew, there were lots of them.
"Quite. I've got as good or better a bed than you, and a fire. And I have a day and night Daihili guard. Now if I could just eat leaves, I'd be as comfortable as if I were in a fine inn."
As Mags had probably hoped, the image of his father eating leaves was comical enough to make Perry smile weakly.
"Now this is what I want you to do for me," Mags continued. "I want you to find out what sort of supplies these people have, and how much. I want you to find out, if you can, what the master wants. What he does with his captives."
"I know some," Perry interrupted him. "He keeps women for breeding. I think maybe he also gives them for a night to people he wants to reward, and..."
He gulped, nauseated again at the memory.
"He eats people. Laurel told me the meat he was eating when he had me brought to him was human."
There was stunned, shocked silence from his father. Silence Perry finally filled.
"I don't know if they're his captives or one of his men that he killed, but like I said, he was eating human meat when I left him, and the captain said I shouldn't accept any food from him, so it's probably not the first time."
Mags was entirely silent for a very long time. So long that Perry began to fear that something had happened to him. Then, finally, he replied,
"That's very strange. Think of him, so I can see what he looks like."
Perry obediently called up the image of the master in his mind's eye, every detail he could remember. He sensed his father studying that image carefully, perhaps even burning it into his own memory.
"All right. Keep clear of him. Try to keep to people you think you can trust. You and I will work out some plans. The more you tell me, the less I think we know of the true situation. Right now, none of this makes sense."
That pretty much summed up his feelings on all sides of this.
"You're useful and uninteresting. That combination should keep him completely uninterested in you, now that he's seen you with his own eyes. I think as long as you don't break character, you're as safe as anyone can be inside that compound. For now, get some sleep. I'll talk to you tomorrow night.
I'm both angry and proud of you, son. You know why I am angry. He faltered. Because of course he knew why Mags was angry. He'd run off like an idiot, confident in being able to stroll into enemy hands, get everything that would prove just how dangerous the master was, and stroll back out again. Well, he was being paid for his stupid overconfidence, and for not doing the smart thing and persuading his father to at least look for the master's stronghold. And when he'd seen just how big that stronghold was, he should have gone straight back to Mags. There was really no excuse for recklessly marching down there and putting himself right squarely in the middle of things. So yes, his father was dead right to be angry with him. But his father's next words shocked him.
We're both at fault. I've been training you for exactly this purpose since you were old enough to toddle, and you went off and did what you were trying to do. So I'm angry with you and with myself, and when this is over, we'll set up rules for both of us to follow from now on. But right now, my sense is that our kingdom may be in danger, and our duty is here.
Well, what could he say to that except,
Yes, sir.
Now sleep, and I love you.
Laurel curled up a little tighter around him, and he lay quietly staring up into the darkness.
You're afraid, Laurel said at last. So am I. We seem to have stumbled into something that is much, much bigger than we thought.
He chewed his lower lip.
Papa thinks so too.
Then you and I are the only ones in position to actually find anything out. I think this is important. The master is more dangerous than we guess. I think he may even be more dangerous than your father guesses.
So what do we do? He asked, then answered his own question.
We treat him that way. We assume he can find out everything about us if we aren't crazy careful. So we'll be crazy careful. Using the ravens again? That's really dangerous, unless there's no other choice.
But Laurel disagreed.
I think he must be like your father, in that he cannot hear animal mind speech. You talking to them should be all right. And using their eyes...
He felt a tiny stirring of hope.
I can do that. And figure out the map of this place. Then at least we'll know how to get out if we have to run for it.
He thought some more.
Do you think he can't get past my shields?
I think he has probably never seen anyone with shields before except for himself. I don't think he knows people without mind speech can raise them.
There was silence for a moment as Laurel considered this.
In fact, I am becoming more sure of this. He believes he has only to drop his own shields to know everything everyone around him is thinking. And if he wants anything, he believes he can easily force it out of them, as he tried with you.
So that's something more we can guess about him.
It was something, anyway.
That is a start,
Laurel agreed.
Now,
he yawned.
Dawn comes early.
Laurel was right. And just that tiny sliver of a plan was enough to allow him to relax enough to sleep again.
I can't keep calling you King Stag, Mag said aloud as he and the King Stag stared at each other across Mag's tiny fire. The Dahili's eyes reflected the firelight in uncanny-looking orbs of glowing green. Behind him, the back wall of the tiny cave they were in threw back the firelight, except where the Dahili's shadow stretched out along it.
Well, you can, actually. It's what I am. But if you like, you can call me Roya, as I told you.
Mags nodded. Thank you. I appreciate that. While it's still fresh in my mind, Roya, I'd like you to look over this master and see if you can tell me anything about him.
He did one more quick check on the master to make sure he was still sleeping deeply, then lowered every one of his shields so Roya could get the most information in the shortest possible time. It was a risk lowering his shields like that, but right now, everything they did was a risk. Roya was in and out of his mind in the time it took for 3 heartbeats. He shielded again. He blinked slowly 2 or 3 times as he purged the little hints of Dahili from his thoughts. Roya had chosen speed over finesse. That was fine with Mags, but it meant he left a little of himself behind. Stray thoughts, scents, even a taste of the sweet clover he had been eating this evening. Nothing disturbing, but it was all very foreign, and Mags needed to chase it away and make it evaporate. Roya folded his legs underneath him and lay down on the sand floor of the cave, the better to ponder what he had learned. One of the Daihili scouts had found this cave, which had no sign nor scent showing that the master's mercenaries had been anywhere near it. It was close enough to the strange city that Mags could reach his son with his gift, but not so near that there was any danger of patrols stumbling on it. It wasn't natural. It looked as if it had been made or carved out for someone or something, possibly as storage or shelter or both. But that was all to the good, because there was a fire pit already here and a crack in the roof to let out the smoke. Mags had been able to cook a meal and warm some water to make pine needle tea. There was something about a fire. It was comforting, even in the worst of circumstances.
I can only assume the master is a changed child,
Roya said at last, and before Mags could ask what that was, he added,
There are pockets of twisted magic in the Pelagirs. The Hawk brothers cleanse the land of these things. That is their ordained duty. But anything living that stumbles into one can be irrevocably altered. I think this master, or its mother, must have done just that.
Well, that would account for why I was such a strong mind speaker, he supposed, and why it looked the way it did.
Does that give it any sort of special weaknesses? He asked.
Not that I know of. It probably has a weakness, but there are no specific ones common to all changed children.
Mags rubbed his temples wearily with his right hand.
Do I report to the king now, when I have so little information?
Compromise, Dallin said, interjecting himself into Mags's thoughts for the first time since they had secluded themselves in this cave. We'll tell Arvel everything we know, and we'll have him take physical notes so he forgets nothing. We'll contact him every evening once you are certain the master is asleep, and we'll tell him that if he doesn't hear from us on a nightly basis, he's to contact the king.
That was as close to perfect as they were going to get.
I agree with that, Roya put in. It is very wise to have someone far from here aware of what we are doing. That is why half my herd is with one of my sons back where you found us, ready to retreat to Hawkbrother lands if he ceases to hear from me. You seek your herdmate. I will guard you from this master while you do so.
Mags nodded. Arvel would not have gone to bed yet.
All right, Dallin. Let's do this now, while Arvel is still awake.
With Dallin's strength supporting him and Roya standing watch on the master's mind, Mags made short work of finding his target. He found the herald sitting up by the fire trying to read a book and actually fretting over them. That made contact much easier. Arvel was surprised, even a little shocked at being contacted mentally, but he quickly recovered and listened to Mags's plan.
Let me go for a little, Mags,
he replied when he understood what it was that Mags wanted.
I can't do this and walk around at the same time, and I need to get something to write with and something to write on.
All right, Mags agreed and released the other herald's mind.
He lay looking up at the crack in the ceiling of the cave, watching the smoke getting sucked up into it, until he thought he'd given Arvel more than enough time to get himself sorted out. When he contacted the other's mind again, Arvel was waiting, ready, sitting at the kitchen table with a good lamp in front of him and plenty of paper. It didn't take long to tell him everything Mags had gathered so far. Arvel wrote it all down faithfully, and before Mags could say anything, he offered,
So are you going to talk to me every night at this time? And if I don't hear from you, I send all this on right away?
Yes, Mags replied, and he sensed Arvel frowning. I don't like this, Mags.
I don't like that Perry is stuck where you can't rescue him. I don't like that you don't have anyone to back you up. You know Pelas and Rio and I can't leave you out there alone, he objected. If you don't contact me,
if I don't contact you, it will be far more important to get this information to the king than it will be to come riding to our rescue, Mag said sternly. I know what I'm doing, Arvel. I've been doing this for decades.
Arvel wasn't very good at shielding his thoughts. Mags clearly heard him thinking,
But that poor little youngling Perry hasn't.
And there was nothing to be said to counter that. Arvel was right. Perry was in the middle of something far more dangerous than his father had any right to inflict on him. But he'd inserted himself there, without Mags's permission. In fact, it had been expressly against Mags's wishes, and at the moment, Mags was unable to think of a good way to get him out that didn't also have an excellent chance of getting him killed.
All right,
Arvel sighed after a long moment of silence. Real silence on Mags's part, pretense of silence filled with anxiety on Arvel's.
I'll do it. I don't like it, but I'll do it. Can I at least try to get some guards up here?
I think you should, if only to protect Withern, Mags replied. If this master gets impatient, he might start sending out squads to abduct people from their homes, rather than wait for appropriate victims to come to the inn.
All right, Arvel repeated. I'll do that. You be careful, Mags.
What was there to say to that?
I will,
he replied, and he cut off the connection before Arvel could sense anything from him other than confidence.
He opened his eyes.
Well, he said, not moving from where he was lying. That's done. Now what?
Now we sleep, Dallin said firmly. That's always good advice when there is nothing else you can do.
14. Perry woke up with the sudden determination to wash all the dogs. Part of it may have been that despite their pine needle beds, they were distinctly unfragrant, which was probably a consequence of their having been neglected for so long. But part of it was because it occurred to him that if the master wanted to keep watch on him, he could use the 4 easily controlled creatures that arrived every morning at sunrise, and there was nothing Perry could do about it. But if the master saw a lot of wet, squirming dogs, well, he'd tire of that pretty quickly. As soon as the helpers cleared the latrine corner of the yard, he called them all together. With what looked like Laurel herding, but was actually Perry telling each dog what to do, he got 4 of them lined up by the water pump, each in the hands of a different helper. And then he set to work. Obviously, the dogs did not like this. What dog ever likes being bathed? But Laurel stood at the head of each as he came into Perry's hands for his bath, then stood aside when Perry let him run loose, and then herded another candidate into the helper's hands as Perry moved on to the next in line. This was quite exciting and active enough for Perry and the poor, bewildered helpers. He felt sorry for the helpers. They'd probably never been told to bathe the dog since they'd been hurt and assigned to kennel duty. But if the master was watching, well, Perry had every hope he'd roll his eyes and find something else to do. It went faster than he'd hoped, but then Mastiffs had very short hair. By the time the boy left the pail with his lunch just inside the kennel door, all the dogs were romping in the yard in every state from still shaking themselves in disgust to completely dry. The meal boy was definitely avoiding him, not that Perry blamed him. Not now, when he knew exactly what the boy was afraid of.
Something occurs to me,
Laurel said as Perry ate his meal and shared some with Laurel.
If the men are going to talk, they will do so at night, when the master sleeps.
They'd have to know he's asleep,
Perry pointed out.
But I guess he would be if all the lights are out in the big house.
He couldn't call it a palace. It didn't look anything like the palace in Haven.
Well, they like me. I can wander out there tonight, join them if they gather around a fire or something of the sort, and we'll see if they talk to each other.
After the bath, and in the heat of the day, all the dogs headed into the kennel for naps. Perry decided that he would take a stroll with Laurel to see what he could see, with the things Mags wanted him to find out in mind. This courtyard actually wasn't anything of the sort, he decided. If anything, it was more like the palace complex back home. The courtyard itself was carpeted in dense grass. When the mercenaries had first arrived here, it must have been waist or chest high. Now it was barely as tall as the first joint of his index finger.
I know what I would have done when I got here. If I had, or could make, sickles, I'd mow it down and dry it, and I'd have hay for the horses for months.
It was pretty obvious what they were doing now. There were horses tethered out all over, keeping the grass short. That big building obviously was something like the palace at Haven, though it was considerably smaller. Then again, there were all those houses outside the wooden wall around the courtyard. Important people in this city could easily have lived out there instead of in here. That building was more than large enough for a single ruling family and their servants. He took a moment to walk around to the front. All he remembered was grass, but now that he was looking for it, there was a ghost of a driveway that went from the gate to the front steps. But the grass had completely overgrown it to the point that you had to look really closely to see it.
How long would that have taken? How long did this place lie empty before the master and his mercenaries arrived?
He went back to begin canvassing all the structures within this fence. Closest to the big building was the kennel, but there didn't seem to be a mews for birds of prey. Maybe whoever had built this